Shalom, welcome to another episode of Inspiration from Zion. I'm Jonathan Feldstein, and I have the privilege of being your host, coming to you from the Judean Mountains here in Israel. I like to refer to it as the original Bible Belt. Inspiration from Zion is a program of the Genesis 1-2-3 Foundation, whose mission is to build bridges between Jews and Christians with Israel in ways that are new, unique, and meaningful. I pray that you will find this, all of those. Through this program, we're excited to connect you to people and stories in and relating to Israel to give you a window to look through, experiencing aspects of life here that you might not otherwise know about. We want this to be interactive, so please be in touch with us at inspirationfromzion@gmail.com and send along any questions and any comments about any topic anytime. Or you can reach us at genesis123.co or follow and like Inspiration from Zion on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Stay tuned until the end, where we always offer an exciting opportunity, and please feel free to share this with others who you know will also find it of interest. So I have a very hard time believing that I'm old enough, much less that today's guest is old enough to have been my professor in 1986 at Tel Aviv University. I remember many of the lessons very vividly, and it's nice through electronic media to have been able to reconnect after all these years, some years ago, and stay in touch. And especially nice today to invite him, Dr. Joseph Olmert, to be our guest on Inspiration from Zion once again, specifically as we talk about what's happening in Syria, what happened in Syria this past week, and what we need to be looking forward to in the coming weeks, months, and as we're on the verge of a new year. Dr. Olmert offers rare combination of talents. He's a top Middle East scholar, former peace negotiator, much published author and journalist, as well as a seasoned public speaker. Until recently, he was an adjunct professor at University of South Carolina, where he was chosen as a student poll as the best USC professor, along with other recognitions and awards. At the retirement party, guests of honor who spoke in his honor included Governor Henry McMaster and others who issued positive statements in honor of Dr. Olmert. In his long career, Dr. Olmert was director of the government press office in Israel, an advisor to former Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir during the first Gulf War and the International Peace Conference in Madrid. He secured press relations for Israel with the Soviet Union and China, represented the Prime Minister in numerous conferences and appearances across the world in places that today we would be scratching our head because they're not so friendly with us anymore. His media experiences, he's been writing a column for many years for Israel's largest newspaper, Yediot Ahronot, as well as the Jerusalem Post, and numerous appearances on radio and TV all over the world. He's a regular columnist for the Huffington Post and writes regularly for Time of Israel, Your Middle East, Fair Observer, Newsmax, and many more. Dr. Olmert, this is very important, actually. Dr. Olmert was a member of the Israeli delegation for peace talks with Syria in the Madrid Peace Conference in the early 1990s, and he participated in numerous international conferences on the Middle East and maintained good working relationships with Arab and Palestinian diplomats. He's of course, fluent in Hebrew, Arabic, and English, and has a command of Russian and French, which all deeply add dimension to his incredible decades of knowledge. In 1999, Dr. Olmert was a policy advisor to former Defense Minister Moshe Ahrens, and in this capacity, he participated in official talks with then-Secretary of State Albright and Defense Secretary William Cohen, as well as with other counterparts in many other countries. As to Israeli public life, he's played a significant role as director and one of the founding members of the Council of Parliamentary Democracy that spearheaded the successful campaign to repeal direct elections for the prime minister. That's perhaps another topic to get into at some point. Dr. Olmert is also very active in public campaigns to promote and enhance the understanding between Arab and Jewish citizens of Israel. He holds a PhD from the prestigious London School of Economics in Middle East Studies, head of the Syria and Lebanon desks at Tel Aviv University Moshe Dayan Center for Middle East and African Studies, where he served on the faculty. He's authored 4 books on the Middle East, as well as numerous articles in important academic journals, Dr. Ulmer has taught at Cornell University, York University in Toronto, City College in New York, and American University, in addition to University of South Carolina. As a speaker, Dr. Ulmer has a very extensive experience in lecturing in colleges and universities across the United States, Canada, Europe, Oceania, and major Jewish and civic organizations, as well as important business meetings where his assessments about global affairs are valued and sought after. Finally, Dr. Ulmer resides in Columbia, South Carolina today with his wife, Diana, and his father to three daughters, two of whom are in Israel and one temporarily in the United States. All of this is to say we have a great expert. I truly can't think of anyone more qualified to speak about what's going on in Syria and what to look forward to. And I remember 1986 very fondly, and I'm very pleased to have you back with you in front of my class once again. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thank you, Jonathan. I appreciate, of course, the great work you do in order to promote relations between Jews and Christians. I think it's a very, very, very significant contribution to the state of Israel.
Thank you so much. Tell me, we woke up Sunday morning this week in the United States, and we discovered that the 5+ decades of the Assad dictatorship was no longer in existence. Did you ever think in all of your decades, with all of your experience, that we would come on this day, just sort of happen overnight, literally?
Well, the truth is I did. It's not Monday morning quarterbacking, because in 2019, I published an article that was against conventional wisdom, in which I argued that Assad did not win the civil war in Syria. So, yes, I wasn't totally surprised, but of course I was taken aback, you know, by the immediacy of all that and how it happened. You know, that's something that you cannot really predict necessarily. But in retrospect, look, here is what happened in Syria. There are two ways to look at it, and one of them would be to look at the overall sense that Syria, like other Arab countries, is basically a failing state, because the entire modern history of Syria was an attempt, if you will, to find out some kind of government or regime or political system that will put together all these different groups, ethnicities, religious groups, and so on, minorities in Syria, and create one nation out of them in a stable political entity. And it failed. All these attempts failed. And what happens now is that they're going to have another experiment in the Islamic regime for the first time in their history. I can tell you now, it will fail. It's just a question of circumstances and time, but that is what is going to happen. They will experience that.
Okay, so I want to get into that, but why would you have said in 2019 or before that? You know, we looked at the Bashar Assad, who was perhaps not as ruthless as his father, who ruled from, what, 1970 until his death 3 decades later, and he was tremendously ruthless. Why was that inevitable to fail? Why did they not hold on?
Look, it is the point that many people don't pay attention to. And I need to say, we in the West, and by the way, including in Israel, we are traumatized, intoxicated, poisoned with media that doesn't tell us the truth about what's happening in large parts of the world. As simple as that. A media that reflects a sense, an opinion, okay, that really believes in political status quo, in what they call stability, in the sense that if something is not dramatically happened in a country, so that's okay, everything is okay, and therefore advocating appeasing this type of political system. And I'll come back to Assad in a minute about that, and creates the impression that, well, everything is okay. Something big has to happen so that you will believe otherwise, but even then they don't report to you about that.
Yeah.
So why did I write this article in 2019? Because I looked at the situation in Syria and saw something very simple. The Druze area was not really under control of Assad. The Kurdish area in the north was not under control of Assad. The Turkish enclave in the northwest that became now the launching pad for the attack on Assad was not under his control. In the desert, ISIS was still around, never mind what Americans or other people said that it wasn't. And basically, Assad controlled about 60% of his territory. Syria became the playground of forces in the region, Iran, Turkey, Hezbollah from Lebanon, Israel had to intervene, America, Russia. The pride of Syria, the art of Arabism, as they used to call themselves, the biting art of Arabism, Syria became a failing state. And therefore, I said, look, he did not win. He is a nominal titular ruler of half or so of what used to be a proud, strong Arab country. But let me tell you something about that. Coming back to the media. I don't work anymore with the African Post. You said that I was for 8 or 9 years, and I wrote hundreds of articles. In one of them, I said, here are 10 statements from prominent people in the world who met Bashar Assad and were impressed. And I'll tell you a story here, which is very significant. Why they were impressed? Because he speaks English. He was educated in England.
Right.
He's one of us. He's a good guy. He's one of us.
You're saying that's what other people projected. You're not saying that
he's one of us. One of them was a professor who is an expert on Syria. Never mind the name. You understand why. And I mentioned his name in the article. Well, he praised Bashar Assad. So he wrote back to me and said, yes, the quotations you used about me was correct. But I'll tell you why I had to write about him. Because I had a friend who studied with me in the university in America. He was Syrian. He came back to Syria. He became a big guy in the regime. He became a minister.
Yeah.
And he invited me to visit Syria. And I visited Syria. And then he told me, the last appointment of yours will be a public speech in the University of Damascus. But, you cannot say a bad word about the boss. Because if you say, I will suffer.
Sure.
So this guy said, I apologize for it. What could I do?
Interesting. Okay.
So why do I tell you all this? Jonathan, and our listeners and viewers, we still do not understand a lot of what's happening in the Middle East or in other parts of the world. And a great deal of blame falls on the media and on some of the universities or academic centers that are teaching and researching along the spirit of what I just told you.
Okay. So
and it's a big, big problem.
It's a big problem, and it's not isolated to the Arab Middle East or Israel. It's a big problem in general. So in your next career, you can work to fix the problem in university.
Say, you know what? I will not be able to fix it anymore, but I have hopes.
Okay.
That things will change now because the landscape starts to move away from all that, you know. I don't want to get into politics and definitely not American politics, but I do know of people who tell me we changed our vote in the elections, whenever it was a few weeks ago, because of what happened in American campuses. All of a sudden, it's a lightning that showed us that things are wrong.
Good.
And that's a very interesting point.
That's very important. So let me ask you a question. Is it an oversimplification? If I want to ask you the question, why did it happen now? Why did it happen this week? Is it an oversimplification to say that Iran invested billions and billions of dollars in three failed entities, that inevitably this was going to happen? I don't know that anyone expected that Israel would be as effective, but thank God. And that also, as soon as Russia got tied up with Ukraine now for 3 years, 4 years, however long that war is going on, Russia's own resources and protecting of its assets and the billions that it's invested in Syria for decades that preceded the Assad regimes. Is it that an oversimplification as to why it happened now, that they were no longer able to hold up Assad?
It's not over and not simplification. It is interesting. There is a connection. Let me explain to you. Look, take, for example, where it all started now. It was in a province called Idlib, which is northwest Syria on the border with Turkey, which for years was under the control of these rebel groups, and basically Turkey. They planned it for a long time. They were waiting for the right time. The right time came now, and I'll come to this in a minute. It didn't occur just like that. They started to rebel, and then they moved. They prepared it. They got the arms, the training, the planning, the guidance from the Turks. There's no question about it. They got it from the Turks. Now, the Turks were very clever, sophisticated, whether we like Erdogan or not, and I don't, but you know, he's a dangerous enemy because he's clever. He's not stupid. He waited for his time. Never mind the formal alliance with Iran and all that. He had his own interests. There's no question about it. Sunnis versus Shiis and so on and so forth. Look. The timing was definitely influenced by what happened in Lebanon, because Hezbollah used to be a main pillar of support for Bashar Assad during the civil war, and they were heavily defeated by Israel. Now, Israel was seen at some point in time after October of 2023 to be defeated and weak, and all of a sudden, after a year, it became the opposite, you know.
Right.
The Iranians suffered a huge amount with the Israeli retaliatory attack, which, hey, look, people don't even talk about it. The Israeli Air Force destroyed the entire air defense system of Iran.
Not just in Iran, in Iraq and all the way up, correct.
Okay, so the Iranians were weak. And of course, the Russians are all the time weak for the last 2 years or so because of Ukraine and all that. So Erdogan chose the timing that was influenced by all that. Basically, look at the irony. Israel is not the cup of tea of Erdogan, but he capitalized on Israel's success to achieve his success at the expense of other people, which is not against our interest, because everything that weakens the Iranians and their proxies is great for Israel. You understand that? Everybody understands that, you know. But
that's what is that saying? The enemy of my enemy is my friend.
But for that matter, you can say it. The Turks are not going to be our friends, you know, and definitely not under Erdogan, you know. So the attack on Assad, therefore, came at the time which was convenient to them, but it was planned before. It was the idea came before, by the way, exactly as was the attack of Hamas on Israel. The Hamas. As we knew now, was planned for years, was sought for years. And look, here is the point that comes back to what I already told you. We are obsessed in the Western world with the sense of peace and quiet. If something doesn't happen, it means that everything is okay. As opposed to the idea that sometimes things do not happen because they are waiting for them to happen in a convenient time for them, not
for them. In their
That's exactly what happened in Syria.
Okay. Very good. Let's take a very quick break. I want to come back and talk about, because honestly, I don't fully understand who's in charge, but let's take a really quick break.
The restoration of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel was an earth-shattering event. For Christians, it was a confirmation that God always keeps his covenantal promises. Today, we are blessed to see God's fingerprints in the modern miracle of the land of Israel playing out in our lives among the people and in the state of Israel. This year, on the occasion of Israel's 75th anniversary, the Genesis 123 Foundation has been privileged to bring together 75 Christian leaders from around the world to lend their unique voices, sharing their personal faith experiences relating to Israel and their in-depth insight into Israel's history and spiritual significance, creating an historical, one-of-a-kind, high-end coffee table book. Israel the Miracle. Israel the Miracle's stunning imagery will fill your home with the hope of fulfilled promises and conversations about Israel. It's a perfect gift to anyone for any occasion, and most of all to yourself. You'll also be a blessing to Israel, knowing that the proceeds will go to bless Israelis of all backgrounds. Be a part of Israel the Miracle and bring the land, the people, and the state of Israel into your heart and into your home. Visit IsraelTheMiracle.com to get your limited edition copy today.
Okay, Dr. Olmert, I am having positive flashbacks to our class together in the spring of 1986. Quite a good experience, and I appreciate the teaching now. I've been traveling and doing a lot of media and speaking, and certainly I don't have the experience that you have, but in terms of people asking me, well, who's in control and what does it look like for Israel these days? I want you to answer that, but I want to tell you what I've been answering, that there are still, although I didn't know that that Turkey had been planning this, as you said, and what a great analogy in terms of the same with the Hamas planned attack. But I've been saying that there are many militias, there are many bad actors, there may be one or two good actors in Syria these days, or people who are trying, and it seems to me that they will be continuing to fight each other, and at some point, some of them, even though they don't have so many weapons anymore, because Israel had a very successful attack on most of the remains of the Syrian military, at some point they may choose to attack Israel, because that's how you garner support among Arabs, by attacking the common enemy, which is Israel. But can you explain who's in control and who are the other parties, and what do we have to look out for that in the coming weeks and months? Because I don't think it's all clear cut.
The term "who is in control" is in itself misleading, because there is no control. That's again one of the mistakes of the Western media. They jump from one extreme to the other. Bashar Assad was stable leader, and after 2 weeks, they already know that the other guy, Gulani, is in control. He's not in control, because first of all, what he has in his command are gangs, organizations that are basically militias, as you say. You know, there's no army anymore. And by the way, what Israel did to the Syrian army was a brilliant operation. And I give you an historic example, by the way, to all those who criticize Israel, they should learn from a guy called Winston Spencer Churchill, the great one. After France capitulated to Germany, what did he do? He ordered the British Navy to destroy the French Navy in Algeria in order to prevent it from falling to the hands of the Nazis.
I didn't know that.
Because in a war, that's what you do.
Yeah.
That's what you do. So in the absence of a real military and police forces that might be, who knows, loyal to whom, you know, the guy, Gulani, that is now making all the statements in Damascus, is the current strong man over a territory that is not even well defined. I mean, it's not even clear where exactly his control is, you know, and so on and so forth. So we are going to have troubles there. Because in a situation like the one that you have had in Syria or during the Lebanese civil wars, in the absence of the real sense of collective identity, of collective solidarity, a civil war breaks society in a way that is like atomization of the society. You have local forces, ethnic, regional, religious, all subgroups raising their heads, you know, and standing now on guard to defend the rights and prevent others from encroaching their territory. So we'll see what happens. I already hear and see reports about executions of Alawis. And some of them are very terrible, you know, but you don't see them in the American press, for example, because now the idea is, let's develop the identity of Gulani. He's a nice guy. I want to tell you something. The same happened after 1979, the Iranian Revolution.
Say the same what?
Idea that those guys are not that bad. Never mind what they said in the
past. Okay.
Because Khomeini, in the beginning, if you recall, maybe you are too young to recall, but I do, he was surrounded by a group of graduates of American elite universities. So they are nice guys. They are our guys. So very soon you will have some kind of good English speakers who will explain that Giuliani is a nice guy and is reforming, change and all that. You know, don't believe all this. Giuliani is the disciple of a Sunni Muslim scholar by the name of Ibn Taymiyyah. Now, Ibn Taymiyyah lived way back from 1263 to 1328. Why is he important? Because he is one of the main fathers of Salafist, jihadist, Islamic doctrines, influenced the Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia later after his death. But most importantly, he issued the famous fatwa about the Alawis of Syria that basically defined them as subhumans because he said they are worse than the infidels.
Okay, can you... I know what you're talking about, but I think probably most people, when you're talking about Alawi, they don't know what you're talking about.
The Alawis are this minority of about 15% of the Syrian population that was the backbone of the Assad regime. The Assads are Alawis. They are not Shiis, even though they are recognized as being Shiis for political reasons. They have their own rituals and doctrines, and they are most despised by Sunni Muslims as being heretics, all the way to even blame them for having paganic rituals and all that, a secret religion. And the fatwa of Ibn Taymiyyah for 700 or 800 years back, and people that listen to us or watch us will say, what is he talking about, 700 or 800 years back? They pay attention to it. They pay attention to it. We don't, but they do. So look, the future is not going to be so simple. There will be mayhem, there will be chaos, you know. In the end, there will be a force that will come out and be stronger, you know. I guess the Turks would like to have an involvement in it. Don't rule out still some influences of pro-Iranian elements because there still are elements that enjoyed from the Iranian presence, you know. In the south of Syria, I believe, I hope, and I believe that Israel should have some kind of informal security zone in cooperation with the Druze population of the south of Syria, which is about 600,000-700,000 people, but well organized and well motivated.
What is what does that look like? Having a combined defense agreement among
It will look like in actions on the ground rather than formal agreements.
Okay.
And I hope that the Americans will not betray the Kurds like Trump did in 2017 when he betrayed the Kurds of Iraq, that he will prevent the Turks from doing whatever, never mind, of doing to the Kurdish enclave in the northeast. So Syria will be informally, but actually divided according to its ethnic religious components, you know, with a strong Sunni control in the Damascus to Aleppo area. Aleppo and Damascus are not twin cities. They have different orientations. Aleppo always look to the north. Damascus look to the south. Different, you know, even Jews from Aleppo and Damascus would always define themselves as different than each
other. That's true, right.
It's interesting, you know. So that's what's going to happen. And it may be, if you ask me, similar to the chaos that existed in Iran after the revolution.
Except after the revolution in 1979, there weren't all of the multi-ethnic groups. There weren't Sunnis and
yes, but, you know, well, first of all, Iran is
multi-ethnic, but they didn't have their militia.
They did have some issues with the Kurds. I agree with you. They had some issues with the Azeris, the Azerbaijanis, you know, that are a huge minority in Iran, about 20 million people, maybe 18 or so million, you know, the big minority. But yeah, you are right. But there were troubles. And there will be troubles in Syria as well. And definitely it will spill over towards Israel because in order to create troubles for Israel, you don't need to have the Syrian army. The Syrian army doesn't exist anymore. It was destroyed.
Right.
But you can have our gangs of people that will still put their hands on what's left of the Syrian army and try to attack Israel by, you know, terror activities. They would call it guerrilla, whatever, but terror activities, you know, that can happen. And I believe that, as opposed to what the IDF did not do for a long time, either in South Lebanon or in Gaza, they do now in Syria. They are acting very quickly and very concretely to try and stave it off, I mean, to prevent it in advance. So I can only hope it will succeed, you know. But don't delude yourself. Those guys that are now so-called in controlling Damascus are not friends, and they are not nice people.
That's what I wanted to ask you. I was with somebody this week who I don't think he has a whole lot of background to make the statement, but he made a statement that he thinks, despite Syria being a failed state, that Syria is going to come along under Trump and become a partner to the Abraham Accords. Is that completely fantasy right now?
First of all, it's a nice fantasy for a chicken. Look, I don't understand Trump policy to be such that he would be ready to pay the price for including Syria in any agreement, because you will have to put $50 to $100 or maybe $200 billion to rehabilitate and rebuild Syria. I mean, you know, the civil war destroyed a lot of Syria, and this one, you know, so there's no army there. They will have to rebuild the army and all that. And by the way, we didn't mention before, so the Russians are having still a foothold, and they are not yet totally out of Syria. And who can send them out of Syria? I mean, you know, have to do it, or else they do it by themselves. They are not going to do it by themselves just like that, you know.
Right.
So there are going to be troubles. And of course, if Trump will be a wizard and a magician, I don't know what, you know, and will bring Syria to the Abraham Accords, I will be happy to tell you I was wrong. But I don't see it happening.
Did you? So let me rewind. I wasn't even going to go this direction. In the 1990s, when you were involved with negotiations with Syria, did you actually think that we could have peace then under Hafez Assad?
No. Look, what happened was Hafez Assad was a clever fellow. I'm sorry. And he understood 1989, 1990, the collapse of the Soviet Union changed everything for him. Egypt was in peace with Israel. Then Saddam Hussein took the Iraqi army and invaded Kuwait. So Assad realized that the overall regional configuration was moving against him. And his readiness to get into negotiations with us was not in order to achieve peace. That wasn't on his agenda. By the way, it wasn't an agenda of Prime Minister Shamir. And retroactively, you can say how right he was, Shamir, because see what happened in Syria. The agenda for Assad was negotiations for the sake of negotiations in order to gain goodwill from the Americans.
I see.
That was the idea. Well, our negotiations, when I participated under the Likud government at that time, were futile, you know. And then the late Rabin government, decided to have negotiations, and they did. And it seemed like Otto is going to happen. It's not. Look, in 2000, few months before he died, Assad, he was almost half dead already by then. He was known to be a dead kind of living guy, you know.
Okay.
He went to Geneva to meet with Clinton. He, by the way, never accepted to go to America. It was like, oh, I don't go to America. I mean, it was interesting. He went to Geneva to meet Clinton. And it was the last desperate attempt by Clinton to make peace, you know. And Assad, of course, said no. A few months later, he died, you know. But he said no when he was already offered 99.8 or 99.9% of the Golan Heights. Even that he refused. And, you know, Netanyahu, Prime Minister Netanyahu, denies now, but he was involved also in negotiations 1998, 1999 with the Syrians that were mediated by very important American Jewish leader, never mind the name. And the idea was also giving up almost everything in the Golan Heights, and Assad refused. Because yeah. Assad, at that time, his mind was already about something else altogether, to prepare his son, Bashar, to take over. It was a big question of Israeli intelligence in the 1990s. When will Assad die? Everybody knew he's going to die. The question is when. It's like if you know about the Spanish history, when Franco, in his last years, you know, the dictator, everybody said, when is he going to die? Because then things will change. And he finally died. So the same happened with Hafez Assad. He died a few, 3 months or so after the meeting with Clinton in Geneva. And then, of course, came Bashar Assad. And I had a debate at the time. Somebody said, you know, it's a new generation, the new king in Morocco, more or less at that time, young guy.
Right.
The current one, king of Dala of Jordan, speaks good English. You know, it's half English even. You know, his mother is English.
Yeah.
And now Bashar Assad, the reformer and all that. And who knows? I mean, we are on the verge of great period and so on and so forth. And nothing happened. At that time, a year later came 9/11. And told, you know, but look, Bashar Assad, in the end of the day, was a tribal leader. He was the leader that his first mission, like his father's, was first of all to make sure that our people, the Alawis,
right,
will not be genocided. When you watch videos about the Syrian civil war from, say, 10 years back or 8 years back, and you see how Alawis were interviewed, they talked like that. They said, those guys look at us like we are vermin, the Sunnis, like we are subhumans. And it is either us, we, or them. Either us or them, you know. And Bashar Assad, with all this Western education, command of English, and appearance, and the wife, and so on and so forth, he basically knew that in order to survive in Syria, he needs to be an ally with Iran. And that was...
So he's no more Soviet Union and the Russians.
That was his insurance, health insurance, policy insurance, if you will, you know, security insurance. And whenever there were talks with Syria, there was always a question that people like us asked behind closed doors. So how can you make peace with Syria if he rules over a country representing a minority, a bloody dictator, a terrible dictator? I mean, you know, how can you do something like that? And, you know, the answer was given by him and his father. They were afraid to do it because they understood that they don't have the real mandate for their people to do that. And they wanted to defend, first of all, their own community. The tragedy is now, or the irony, if you will, that now is Assad gone. You don't like to be an Alawi in Syria today. Trust me, you do not want to be. Trust me, you do not want to be an Alawi in Syria.
Which has two components. It has the component, what you're saying, the fatwa from 800 years ago, and that they're looked upon as subhuman. But it also has to do with the fact that for almost 60 years, Alawis have controlled Syria, and not just controlled Syria, but ruthlessly against Sunnis and others. So the fact that that they have this social status that they do just means that everyone else wants to exact their revenge.
Well, there will be troubles. Look, I remember 2012 or so, a few months after the beginning of the civil war in Syria, I met a Syrian opposition activist in D.C. I was asked to meet with him. We had lunch, you know, and so he told me, you know, I served in a battalion, whatever, in the Syrian army. So most of the soldiers were Sunni Muslims like me, but I remember the numbers even, 106 out of 115 officers were Alawi. So you understand, of course, I mean, the ordinary Sunni soldier did not think that he needs to sacrifice their lives in order to save Bashar Assad, but those Alawis who did it him, look, the Alawi community decimated in the civil war. Young people died. I mean, the soldiers, you know, the core of the Syrian army, they paid the price in the civil war and all that, you know. And now you read, I guess you also read in the Israeli press, the descriptions of the Israeli soldiers in the what used to be Syrian positions, Syrian camps along the border, all looked like terrible shape. I mean, everything was rotten, everything was obsolete, everything was useless, and so on and so forth. By the way, the same stories you heard about Russia after the initial failures in Ukraine war, and all of a sudden experts told you, you know what, we are not surprised because that's what we thought about the Russian army.
Interesting. Yeah. Let's take another quick break, and I want to come back and begin to look forward. What do we need to be looking in the weeks, months, and year to come?
Friends, Israel's at war, and the war may get worse before it gets better, much worse. It's going to be a long war because the enemy is the epitome of evil. It's not just a matter of overcoming troops on a battlefield, but overcoming a theology, an ideology, an evil one. While the Genesis 123 Foundation has been overwhelmed with the support of so many donations to the Israel Emergency Campaign, there's so much more that needs to be done. We've invested your donations that we've received so far strategically to make the biggest impact possible, whether helping with soldiers and their equipment and personal needs, to providing civilian security for outlying border communities, to relocating and settling several families from near the Gaza war zone, launching the global petition drive to support Israel in the face of pressure for a ceasefire, and long-term needs for at-risk children, traumatized now more than ever before. Please take a moment to pause this conversation right now and go to love.genesis123.co and donate generously. We value your trust, and we will keep all donors informed about how and where your donations are being used to contribute to make the biggest impact possible. And when you use that link, love.genesis123.co, you can also send your prayers and words of encouragement to Israelis of all backgrounds, just sending your love, something that we need so desperately. Thank you, and God bless you and your loved ones.
Okay, Dr. Olmert, amazing. So what do we need to look for? You've got all of these groups. Iran doesn't want to lose its complete influence. Russia doesn't. Turkey seems to be coming out as a winner. Actually, I have a question before you answer that. Before we talk about big picture, Turkey as a member of NATO, if it attacks U.S. troops or other NATO troops in Syria, is that a violation of NATO terms?
Yes, it is. But I will not do that. Look, Erdogan is very careful. You know, he's very clever. That's why he's so dangerous. Because, you know, we look at dictators, they're dictators, and we kind of, you know, he's a smart fellow, and he's not going to fight American troops in Syria. That's why I said before, the Americans will have, it's their responsibility to take care of the Kurds, to prevent the Turks from genociding the Kurds and taking over the territory in Syria. They should prevent it. They should help the Kurds.
You don't necessarily believe that.
Look, the isolationist voices coming out from the Trump entourage are very worrisome to me.
Yes.
Very worrisome to me, you know, and I know that everybody is expecting to, who knows what will happen with Trump with regard to Israel, but you know what? Yes. Definitely going to be far friendlier on many accounts, many levels, and so on. But the sense of isolationism, the sense of, you know, leave us alone, basically, it's not our business, is worrisome. And we have to watch it. So you asked me about the future. Look.
Yes. Okay, good.
You, of course, want to know about Israel. No, my opinion is just a private opinion, but I think it is not a minority opinion necessarily. Look, the question for Israel is very simple. Okay, we are winning. Israel is winning. It's a tremendous achievement. Hamas is defeated. Hezbollah is defeated, at least for the time being. And now Syrian army is a story of the past. And Iran is much weaker.
Yeah.
So what is really the strategic end game for us? It is what it has been for years, the Iranian nuclear program.
Okay.
That's the end game.
So everything else, Turkey taking over.
Everything else is important. This one is existential.
Okay.
That's how I build it. So look, that's a political decision that is also, of course, in the first place, also a military strategic decision. And that depends a lot on the American administration, the new one, on Trump. The voices coming from him are confusing. On the one hand, I'm ready to do whatever, I'm ready to negotiate. On the other hand, I think he said today, whenever we are talking at the time, that all the options are on the table about war with Iran. So, I mean, we'll see what happens. From an Israeli perspective, look, Iran built tried to build what they call the Shi'i Crescent.
Yes.
Israel has broken it. Israel, it's something huge for the Western world. Forget about ourselves, but Western world. But, you know, there's anti-Semitism. You heard about that, of course, and people are, you know. We need to decide on priorities. And the number one priority is Iran nuclear program. Syria is a tactical situation now. The same Hezbollah and Hamas. Iran continues to be the strategic overall threat.
Okay.
It still is the presence of the Houthis in Yemen, which on occasion send a missile or so, and that should be dealt with as well. But that's, again, tactical.
Yes.
So what Israel will do about Iran, with or without the U.S., will have repercussions about Syria and Lebanon, because without the Iranian support, Hezbollah is dead.
Yes.
But then, just to make it more complicated, if Iran is dead, who would be in Syria? That will open up for the Turks. So it's a very delicate balance here.
So wait, are you suggesting that we need Syria to still have some sort of Iranian influence? So
no, all I'm suggesting is that the options are not good and better.
Okay.
They're bad and worse.
Well, someone asked me.
They're reasonable and bad.
So someone asked me recently who we should be supporting in this revive revolution that was taking place. And my response was they should all be successful in terms of killing one another.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, remember when there was the Iraq-Iran war, the then Israeli chief of staff, Raful Eitan, General Raful Eitan, said, you know, every day that passes is a great day. I mean, they, you know, they do what otherwise we should have done, and they do it for themselves. Look, by the way, the Iranians are a key player here, because if they really decide that they still want to invest in Iraq, they're still there, you know, and through Iraq in Syria, that's between them and Turkey, not between them and us.
Ah, okay.
You know, that's between them and Turkey. If on the other end, the Iranians decide we leave Syria and we leave, you know, we are not there anymore. We lost. I mean, you know, the investment is lost in Lebanon. What can we do? They might intensify the nuclear program exactly because they will see through the Nobel. So it comes back to what I told you. Strategically, existentially, the Iranian nuclear program is the number one priority. But that's an opinion.
Well, that's not an opinion. It's a factual statement, because there has never been and there is not an existential threat against the state of Israel. We may have thought that was 1967. There could have been, but that was miraculous and we won. But there's never been this existential threat. And they could have a nuclear weapon by the time Trump is inaugurated.
But that's exactly the point. You see, that's exactly the point. They hold the key, not the key, not only them, all the keys, but they hold the big key, an important key. And we'll see what they do. If they decide to cut their losses and leave Syria and Lebanon, they failed. There will be troubles within the regime there. That's another story, because of, you know,
okay,
settling scores between people and factions. But it could still lead them to intensify the nuclear program, because they will feel more vulnerable, as I said. So we have to be very careful here, and we have to understand that in a situation like that, you have levels of dangers.
Okay, so
is more and what is less, and in what time you can deal with the more as opposed to the less.
Okay, so good. Now, Tachlis, what bottom line? When, at what point does Israel need to act the same way we just acted by essentially destroying the Syrian military against the Iranian nuclear facilities?
Yesterday, today, tomorrow, 21st of January, nothing will happen without coordinating it with the Americans. I mean, let's be honest about that. I mean, no Israeli government of responsibility will do something like this without at least getting a sense of what the American reaction would be. I don't know what's going on behind closed doors now. I'll be surprised if this is the number one topic, because the immediate situations are always surpassing, you know, the more strategic issues. But Iran today is in a very, very low and weak point. And that's, by the way, why I didn't like the way the ceasefire was done with Hezbollah, because it was done at a time when Hezbollah was almost on the ropes. A little bit more, they would be totally there. You know, okay, but that's spilled milk now. Some would say spilled blood, of course, is more important. The question about Iran is not to be measured in months, in many months. It should be measured in weeks or few months. Okay. Time is coming for this crucial decision.
Okay. Hopefully there will be.
Well, hopefully there will be. Hopefully it will be a successful decision. Awesome. Hopefully it will be a victory. But, you know, look, we talk here about situations that could be so, you know what they say about war. You know how you start, you never know how you end it.
Well, this is true. But one of the unique things which has not happened in Lebanon yet, in terms of the defeat of Hezbollah, hopefully with a strong enough military defeat of the Iranian regime, the nuclear weapons, the IRGC, maybe a dead Ayatollah or two, hopefully the Iranian people will rise up as they've been trying to do and be the other part of that.
That is always a possibility. That is always a possibility. But again, this regime is hated by many Iranians, but liked by many others also. I mean, it's not, you know, regimes like this have their own support, even though it may be smaller than what it used to be or what they claim it to be. Because there are those who enjoy from the regime. There are those who benefit from it. And by the way, there were those who benefited from the Assad regime, and not just Alawis, the business people in the Aleppo or in Damascus that enjoyed the corruption of the regime, you know, and were part of it and all that. So, you know, all this remains to be seen. But coming back to Iran, the point has to be made. Look, in a situation like Israel is in, you have to decide on what is more, what is less dangerous. And the Iranian plan was that if Israel or the U.S. and Israel or only the U.S. or only Israel are about to attack us, we have Hezbollah and Hamas and the Syrians and the Iraqis and the Yemenis all converging on America and Israel, you know, and this is fantasy now.
Yes.
All I hear about Iraq, for example, is very interesting. Many Iraqi Shiis say, you know what, we don't want to suffer. You want to fight the Iranians, do it by yourself. We are not part of it. It's interesting.
Interesting.
Yeah, there are voices like this and very strong voices. So it just shows to you, Iran is the head.
Yes.
You cut the head. Or what?
You have to cut the head. And it's the head of the octopus. And people know this. They learned it in third and fourth grade, that an octopus can regenerate its tentacles. So the longer we allow the head to continue to exist, Hezbollah can come back and something.
Hezbollah will try to come back, but if Iran is defeated, Hezbollah can't come back.
Can come back, correct.
Hezbollah is the baby of Iran.
Correct. And then maybe. And then
genuine issues in Lebanon, but without Iran support, it would have been yet another organization. Now they are monster. They've become monster because of Iran.
Right. Okay. Fascinating how the conversation, and not surprising, begins with Syria and ends in Iran. But I want to come, okay, but that's where we are. And that's important. It's an important lesson in our class today. But I want to come back to Syria for one thing. I remember it as a young man. You, of course, were a little bit older and much more connected. But it's not, I don't know if you remember. I don't know how old you are and what your memory is. But we can't think of Syria and not think of Eli Cohen, our spy, who was hung in 1965, and whose body we don't know where. Do you think that this offers us an opportunity to somehow find his body and bring his body home?
Where this somehow? That's a delicate. I don't want to get into this in details for all kinds of reasons.
Okay.
If his bones will be brought back to Israel, it will be my happiest day in life. That I can tell you. I became a Syrian so-called expert, specialist, let others decide if I am, you know, because of the Eli Cohen story of 1965, you know, I was fascinated as a child, you know, as a kid. I was 15, so now you know how old I am.
Oh, you remember. Okay, you do remember.
And I remember everything, you know, and that really attracted me to Syria, and I became fascinated with all that, you know. It's a tragic story, and sometimes stories are becoming more tragic because they really do not have an end. That could be the case here. And I'm afraid it is going to be, but I hope I'm here. I'll be so happy to be wrong. I'll be ecstatically happy to be wrong. But it could still be a story without an end.
Yeah. But is this the best opportunity now with this change that
I don't know if there were other... Look. The question is a bit problematic, pardon me for saying so, because if it says today is the best opportunity, it's like until now there were no opportunities. The question, what is opportunity?
Okay.
Opportunity in a situation like this is a combination of factors. One of them is knowledge. The other one is ability.
Okay.
If you don't have the knowledge, doesn't matter the ability. If you have
doesn't
the ability.
Doesn't matter. Correct.
So, you know, I don't think that at any given time, there was definite knowledge coinciding with definite ability.
Okay, excellent.
And I still don't know if today there might be the knowledge, even though the ability may exist.
Okay.
That's how I put it to you.
Okay. And I neglected for people who are following who may not know the story. First of all, you have to come to Israel and come visit on the Golan, and we'll talk about Eli Cohen, but his story was made famous in the book Our Man in Damascus, which is still available in print, and Netflix did a 4-part series that was a good story. It wasn't necessarily 100% accurate. I forget what that series was called, but definitely a worthwhile story of Eli Cohen, one of Israel's greatest spies, who was caught in Damascus and hung, and whose body we still hope to get back. Dr. Ulmer, before we conclude, we've covered a long, large range of territory in this class, and a semester's worth. What did we not cover that people need to know? What's happening this week, next week, and what did we miss?
Well, no, just to mention, because we talk to a Christian audience, that there is a Christian minority in Syria that dwindled in numbers. There still was, and there still is, a small community of Aramaic speakers in Syria. One of the two languages is Jesus Christ. The other one was Hebrew, of course. And they are in between the Amr and the Anzavir. The traditional enemies of the Christian Syria were not the other minorities, it were the Sunni Muslims.
Yeah.
The big massacre in Damascus in 1861 was by Muslims, Sunni Muslims.
Yes, okay. Yeah.
And Bashar Assad, by the way, had support of Christians because he tried to create an alliance of all the minorities to shore up, you know, more support to his regime. And the founder of the Baas Party was himself Christian, Michel Aflaq was the Orthodox Christian. So I think that our Christian audience need also to be aware of the fact that there might be troubles with the Christians now, and that should be one more reason to expect the Trump administration, or even to put pressure on them, not to run away from Syria, but to be very much on the watch of what's happening over there, because among other problems, there could be troubles also to the Christians that are still there. The numbers used to be about 10% of the population. I think it dwindled to maybe 5 or 6%, which might still be over 1 million.
Yeah.
It's a large minority, large group, and we have to pay attention to that.
Thank you for pointing that out.
Yeah.
Dr. Joseph Ulmer, well, always a delight. I love that we're in touch a little bit on social media and following you, and some worth following me in all of your social media. I'll put your links in the show notes for this. I want to thank you so much for taking time. It's late there tonight, and I'm very grateful for you taking the time.
Thank you very much, and continue doing the good job. Take
thank
care.
You so much.
And happy Hanukkah and happy New Year and Merry Christmas.
Amen. As we always say at the end, if you stay with us this late, you deserve a reward. And we've been offering for the last number of years a great gift from Jonathan's bookshelf. I'm not actually sitting in my office today looking at my books, but a little over a year ago, just before the war began, we started offering a unique gift that all we ask you to do to be eligible to receive this gift is share, comment, or like the link to this program, and we will enter you for a drawing in our magnificent book, Israel, the Miracle, that came out just before the war began in September of 2023. So please do share, comment, and like this program. We're always grateful that this podcast is sponsored by our friends at the Willow Run Greenhouse in Culpeper, Virginia. If you're ever in the area, pop in and thank them for helping make conversations like this possible. And also special thanks to the Coyne family for their meaningful sponsorship. Inspiration from Zion and all the Genesis 123 Foundation programs are made possible by donations. So please consider joining us to help continue the dialogue and build bridges. And if you'd like to sponsor a future episode of Inspiration from Zion in honor or memory of a loved one or a special occasion, or maybe your favorite Tel Aviv University college professor, please be in touch at inspirationfromzion@gmail.com. We love to hear your comments always as part of a dialogue and invite you to send any questions as well, especially questions you have about traditional Judaism for our Ask the Rabbi programs. Please share this with others who also find it of interest and continue to join us right here as we bring you more meaningful conversations about unique topics relating to Israel that you won't hear anywhere else. Wherever you are in the world, I pray that you and your loved ones are all safe and healthy, and I send my blessings from right here in the Judean Mountains. God bless you.